fai male, fai male. Buon colota, buon colota, fai male.
Timbo Sounds of Culture.
Fai male, fai male. Venga, fai male. Fai male, fai male. Venga, lo fai male. Fai male.
Oh, lesithombe osipostile namajita lawalana asefikile vele sholile sayisukile sesgesile ngokwesikhathi vele ngabe sengilokile sahlanyiswa ilesithombe osipostile namajita lawalana asefikile vele sholile sayisukile sesgesile kapsa Gagal shoni langa
Gagal chambe
Ngap sa kala
Sensele
Gagal shoni langa
Gagal chambe
Baby ngap sa kala
Sensele
Gagal shoni langa
Gagal chambe
Ongyatanda sofi
My baby ngensa
Mina yatanda sofi
My baby ngensa
Mina yatanda
In the mix with Dr. Kenya OC, exclusively on WRCT and Milwaukee Radio.
was to open its arms to me. The hidden Africa, which even at that time was beginning to slowly vanish. A new world was opened to me. New vistas of knowledge beckoned to me like distant mountains. I began to learn about our people. I began to learn about the ancient law. I was told many things as I went through the rituals of initiation. In Africa, when you are an initiate, you must obey your teachers without question. You must never talk back to them. You must gather firewood in the forest and bring it to you, to the place of initiation. You must never think of anything outside the circle of initiation. You had to dance strenuously. Special skin, which was
JOC, hey, I'm in a lot of trouble with my woman, and I need you to play that special song for me. Can you play?
Timbo Sounds the Culture.
Hi, this is Kenny.
And Amanda Smith from Nashville, Tennessee.
Keep it right here on WRCT Pittsburgh.
Jalem, Jalem, Lungone, Domen, Maladile.
From the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, those with a beating heart can see the horror of Trump's plans to deputize wannabe vigilantes, to denounce community members they suspect don't belong here, to send ICE into schools and churches to round folks up, police records or no, and ship them to detention centers, and to ride roughshod over time-honored concepts of sanctuary. But on immigration, as on many other things, corporate news media have shaped their narrative around right-wing frames, such that immigration itself is now not primarily a human rights story or even an economic one, but yet another story about their crimes and our safety. Sure, it serves racist xenophobes and will ultimately harm all of us, but horrible crimes attachable to brown and black people? You don't have to ask the press corps twice. It was bad enough when the narrative was about distinguishing good immigrants from bad immigrants. We've now gone beyond that to all immigrants versus everyone else. And if MAGA is now driving that train, well, elite news media have been fueling it up for years. We'll talk about the not new but accelerating, and yes, bipartisan, attack on immigrants and about the resistance to it with Silky Shah, executive director at Detention Watch Network. That's coming up, but first a look back at some recent press. Sometimes the headline says it all, as with the New York Times on January 17th. If Democrats attack Trump's rich pals as oligarchs, will it stick? The piece itself presents Elon Musk's influence on the new administration as something Democrats have suggested. The role of Trump's billionaire allies is something Democrats plan to invoke in the fight over tax cuts. And the idea that Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, and Jeff Bezos might be front and center at the inauguration wasn't meaningful in itself so much as something Democrats saw as an irresistible opportunity to further highlight those connections. Is it true that the Trump administration, slated to be the richest presidential administration in modern history, not even counting Elon Musk, represents oligarchy? That's not the point. The important question is, will such a clearly defined as partisan charge stick? What it means for a charge to stick and what role news media like themselves have in sticking it are not things the Times would have you consider. For its part, on January 20th, AP went with the headline, Trump, a populist president, is flanked by tech billionaires at his inauguration. Over a piece noting that as a, quote, shift from tradition, especially for a president who has characterized himself as a champion of the working class, close quote. So is it a wacky juxtaposition or a sign that elite media don't see as much of a story in whether Trump is a champion of the working class as in whether he or others characterize him that way? It would be work enough to counter the actual things actually happening without news media dedicating themselves to putting up a rhetorical scrim between us and the things we need to understand to resist. And speaking of billionaires and the press, as the Washington Post faces a staff rebellion and plummeting subscription rates, billionaire owner Jeff Bezos has introduced a new mission statement, quote, riveting storytelling for all of America, close quote. Fair's Julie Holler explains that this new path forward, as introduced in a slide deck to Post staff by the paper's chief strategy officer, Susie Watford, demands that the paper, quote, understand and represent interests across the country, close quote, and, quote, provide a forum for viewpoints, expert perspectives, and conversation, close quote. This appears to mean shifting resources toward opinion, specifically opinions from the right. According to a New York Times report, Bezos has, quote, expressed hopes that the Post would be read by more blue-collar Americans who live outside coastal cities, mentioning people like firefighters in Cleveland. He has also said that he is interested in expanding the Post's audience among conservatives, close quote. The Post, we're told, has already begun to consider ways to sharply increase the amount of opinion commentary published on its website. Given that the paper already has more columnists than you can shake a stick at, Holler notes, this new direction sounds like the foxification of the paper, a move away from any attempt to hold powerful people to account towards inexpensive clickbait punditry. Watford's slide deck presented three pillars of the Post's new model: great journalism, happy customers, and make money. Just days before the new mission statement was revealed, over 400 staff members signed a letter to Bezos saying they were, quote, deeply alarmed by recent leadership decisions that have led readers to question the integrity of this institution, broken with a tradition of transparency, and prompted some of our most distinguished colleagues to leave, with more departures imminent, close quote. Bezos's response, a slide deck about riveting storytelling that prioritizes churning out opinions to draw in conservatives, is unlikely to ease the mind of any serious journalist at the paper. Nor is trying to expand the Post audience among conservatives while still paying lip service to great journalism likely to solve their problems, as CNN, for example, has discovered. Because, once more with feeling, you cannot do good journalism while trying to appeal to both sides in the context of an increasingly radical right, because that side demands acceptance of lies and conspiracy theories that are incompatible with actual journalism. When Jeff Bezos bought the Post, he told employees that, quote, the paper's duty will remain to its readers and not to the private interests of its owners, close quote. And that sentiment was repeated in Watford's slide deck to staff. But Bezos's actions in the past months, including the killing of the paper's Kamala Harris endorsement, Amazon donating $1 million to Trump's inaugural fund, and paying Melania Trump $40 million for her self-produced documentary, and then, of course, Bezos standing on stage alongside other multi-billionaires at Trump's inauguration, they make clear that that principle is as meaningless to Bezos as the slogan that they debuted after Trump's first election, "Democracy dies in darkness." That slogan will continue to appear on the front page for the time being anyway, perhaps, Holler writes, in the hope that readers searching for an actual news organization that holds those in power to account will be fooled into subscribing. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The Trump administration surprised none but the gullible by coming out of the gate with a spate of hateful, discriminatory, and anti-democratic measures. Immigrants, that's to say mainly brown and black immigrants, have been in the sights of those who oppose the Democratic Project for years now. But with day one orders and directives threatening roundups and mass deportations and curtailing sanctuary, the new White House looks to be defining terrorizing people as policy. I wonder if major news media day in and day out reported immigration not through politicians trying to outdo one another with hysterical claims and perverse stunts like buses out of town, not through pundits whose ignorance of history and economics is matched only by their indifference to human rights, but instead through the voices of immigrants and their communities and advocates, would we be where we are today? Silky Shaw is executive director at Detention Watch Network. She joins us now by phone from Washington State. Welcome back to Counterspin, Silky Shaw.
It's great to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, the Department of Homeland Security's directives to rescind the sensitive locations memo is so exemplary of the comic book cravenness. There is no safe place. This chaotic routing out of human beings, this is really what we want to do. If people don't know, or if they somehow think this is about isolating criminal actors, what should we understand as some of the key and foreseeable impacts of this slew of orders on communities, whether or not they or a family member is ultimately actually deported?
I think the whole intention here is to cause fear and instability in people's lives, and the strategy of sort of forced attrition, forced self-deportation. So it's like a combination of all the different orders that have been put in place. Some of them are being blocked, like the birthright citizenship order, again, just to kind of cause panic in people, but it's very much unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. And there's other things that people are filing litigation against, but we have a lot of the system in place already. There are thousands of ICE agents and thousands of CBP, Customs and Border Protection agents, and they've already started doing roundups, and we've seen that across the country, but we also know they work really closely with law enforcement at every single level, at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level. And so much of what people have done for many years to protect communities is by doing that work to get ICE out of those particular locations, out of churches, out of schools, out of hospitals, and also do that work to make it so that ICE and police aren't collaborating, because that's actually how we saw a lot of people funneled into deportation proceedings and into the detention system, especially during the Bush and Obama years. And so that work, for many years we've been doing that, and everything this administration is trying to do is to undo a lot of that work so that they can target people more easily. And so even now we've seen that they've directed DOJ to start potentially looking into prosecution for states and counties and cities that aren't complying, which is also going to be challenged. But I think that is the intent. The intent is to undo so much of the work we've done to protect immigrant communities and stop the really severe deportations we've seen.
Well, you're sort of touching on it, but it seems worth pulling out. Elite media won't do it, but we can ourselves shift this idea that Democrats are by definition anti-Republicans, and that we're really in a Trump versus anti-Trump situation. And it's not to ignore partisan dynamics, but just to recognize bad ideas, whoever is pushing them.
Yeah, I think one thing that was so challenging for us coming into 2025, we were all sort of bracing ourselves for what was going to happen a few days ago on January 20th, but already within the first days of the year, we saw the Democrats both in the House and the Senate capitulating and now officially passing the Laken-Riley Act, which right. Is now Trump is going to sign soon. And it's really disturbing because it's a bill that was really created around a moral panic, which exacerbates all these questions and scapegoats, immigrants as the problem around this really horrific tragedy, but saying, oh, we're going to apply these really harsh policies to all immigrants because of this one incident, which we saw in the 80s with the story of Willie Horton. And then that was one of the things, of the many things that led to the U.S. being one of the world's leading incarcerators and the growth of mass incarceration. And now we're seeing that again, where Democrats are capitulating because of the moral panic that was created around this one incident and saying that immigrants are the problem and sort of equating them with criminality. And I think that is something that was really hard to stomach, to see how much the Democrats accepted this really harsh bill that will require mandatory detention for people who are just charged with theft-related crimes. It would expand the number of people who would be forced to be in detention without any due process, without any ability to say before a judge, these are the reasons why I shouldn't be in here. And so we're really, really concerned, especially that so many Democrats capitulated on this. It's the same old story. It's the moral panic that they sort of capitalize on to gain political legitimacy. And then we see these really harsh policies in place that just balloon incarceration, balloon policing.
Yeah. And it's such a circle because, for example, Associated Press, in reporting the House approving Lake and Riley, sort of notes matter-of-factly, well, yes, there was this crucial faction of 46 politically vulnerable Democrats
right.
who joined with Republicans. Why are they politically vulnerable? Because of this situation in which they feel themselves being pushed to align with Republicans in order to stay in office, which apparently is job one and job only for many folks.
Well, and one of the things around that that's so frustrating is that part of the reason they are feeling the need to do that is because the Democratic Party has really failed to offer any counter vision to the Republicans, failed any countervailing vision. In fact, Harris ran a campaign where she was positioning herself as more hardline than Trump on immigration, and that opened up space for us to be in this place. And so I think that is really one of the most important lessons right now, is that no, we have to offer something else. We have to not just throw immigrants under the bus as the Democrats did in this election cycle that have sort of led us to this point and enabled Trump and all of these other Republicans to sort of move these policies. And yeah, no, I think absolutely there's no question that the Democrats also deserve equal blame for where we're at.
Right. I'm going to bring you back in a second to what we can be for, but I did want to step out and just say a key part of your concern and your work is that for many people, because it's how media frame it, the idea is, well, in one way or another, we're going to catch lawbreakers or even spread a net that catches up some folks who aren't breaking the law, but then we're going to do something with them. And the story sort of ends there. And I wonder, what does your understanding of the actual immigrant detention system as it exists tell you about that as a solution that maybe most people don't even know?
The thing about detention is that it exists to warehouse immigrants. That's what it exists to do. Mm-hmm. And whether they have had interaction with the criminal legal system or not, yes, many people have, some people haven't, some people are there because they're seeking asylum. But it tells you that the bigger picture of the U.S., again, being so committed to incarceration, still having some 2 million people in jails and prisons and detention centers, and what we saw for many, many years is the growth of these systems because there was this sort of incentive to have some economic viability for rural communities. There was the prison boom that happened, and there was also the destruction of the welfare state and right. many people sort of being caught up in the system. And so people became more and more eligible for prison time. There was longer sentences and sentencing and mandatory minimums and all these things where we sort of balloon the system, and all those things started applying to immigration, and that's what we saw with the detention system. And even to this day, when we try to make the case against immigrant detention and local officials can meaningfully say, well, actually, we hear you. We don't think people should be in detention because they're just awaiting a hearing on their immigration case or they're awaiting deportation. But then they're still hesitant to end the contract, largely because they are still getting federal money to hold people in the detention system. They're still, even if they have a private prison in their community, they might be getting a dollar a day to hold a person in that facility. And so there are a lot of perverse incentives to the system that include both the private prison industry, but also county jails and just the way law enforcement works across the country. And so I think that's a really important piece of it. And the other thing I would say is that there's just this constant lie that's told to us that immigration is a issue of public safety and national security. And of course, now we're hearing this a lot in what the executive orders have put out, but it's not true, actually. Immigration is about labor, of course, and I think that's going to become more of an issue as the crackdown happens and people sort of feel the impacts of losing that labor, but also it's about family relationships and it's about seeking refuge. And so we have to go back to that sort of conversation of what is immigration about? What can we do instead of reinforcing these ideas that people are lawbreakers? Well, what does that mean in the context of the law right now? And how has the system changed to sort of round up and warehouse more and more people, mostly people who are Black and brown?
Right. Well, we are seeing and we will see a lot of rightful and righteous against energy. And I wonder, what can we be for? What ideas can we shape conversations around that both resist the worldview of the MAGA set and their media enablers, but also maybe have nothing to do with them? What are some other ideas that can be coherent that we can work around going forward?
Well, I think what was so evident about how the 2024 election worked out was, and largely part of the reason that the Democrats capitulated, was that actually Governor Greg Abbott of my home state of Texas really, really played the game and positioned immigrants as a problem. It was a lot of people focused on Trump, but I think Abbott, with the scheme where he was busing migrants right to cities like New York and Chicago and quote unquote bringing the border to those cities, it sort of exacerbated and revealed all the sort of fractures in the social safety nets that exist in those places, especially in light of the pandemic and sort of how there was more of a housing crisis. There's obviously opioid crisis. There's so many other things that communities are negotiating. And because there was that anxiety in those places and that fear around economic insecurity, immigrants became a really easy scapegoat. And so from my perspective, I think, again, this sort of goes back to this question of the Democrats failing to offer any countervailing vision. It wasn't just on immigration, but it was just generally offering something about what is the public good and what can we do for people and how can we help people and how do we get to a place where people aren't feeling nervous about paying rent and anxious about all the other things and the price of goods in the grocery store and all the other things that were happening, and how can we make sure that Democrats are responding. And so I think from my perspective, we've had a lot of conversations with people on the ground, especially in light of the fact that people are worried about a detention center closing down and not having those jobs. It's like, well, what is the economy you want in those communities? What is a just transition to that? What are sort of more healthy economies than having incarceration or a military base or something like that? And so moving more away from the sort of scarcity mindset and making conditions for people in the U.S. better, I think, is going to be an important part of our strategy to make the case for immigration. Also, of course, even I think sometimes this continues to get lost, is the root causes of migration aren't always a part of the conversation. And so also, like, what is the role of the U.S. and in the U.S. across the world, and how have they exacerbated these conditions, and what can we do around that?
I wanted to just draw out one point of information, which is that just because the U.S. outsources detention to Mexico, for example, doesn't mean it's not on our watch, right? That's just as a point of information.
Yeah, I think actually the last time I talked to you, it was after a really big fire that happened in one of the facilities on the other side of the border in Mexico. And I think that's the reality, is that in so many ways, Mexico absolutely has the second highest rate of detention in the world. And it might look a little bit different, I think, in the U.S. context, because it's been such a society that's obsessed with imprisonment.
Right.
We have detention centers that actually are mostly jails or former prisons that are used. And so, but I think there you might have different types of facilities. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that sort of externalization that we've seen is also on the U.S. So it's not just that they're doing it here, but they're doing it abroad. I think the concern for us, we've done some research on this, is that when you have a detention center close to a location, so for instance, in Southern California and San Bernardino County, where the Adelanto Detention Center is, when it was built and went up or started holding people in 2010, 2011, I believe, San Bernardino County ended up having the second highest ICE arrests in the country. And so just by having the capacity there, more people are going to get detained. And so that's a lot of the reason why we do the work to shut down detention centers or stop expansion here. But I do absolutely agree that a lot of our work also needs to be making sure that the U.S. is not just outsourcing a lot of the same policies and tactics to other parts of the world.
Well, finally, even as the internet connects us in many ways, there's still this sort of atomism in modern U.S. life. And we're inundated with this notion that, to put it very crudely, success means starting your own thing, inventing something new and selling it. And that whole mindset works against the collective action that we need so much now and that we know works. Detention Watch Network, as the name suggests, is a coalition. And that formation shapes the work. And that seems very much like a way forward. It's less media friendly, you know, so many voices, so many groups, who do we quote? But that kind of work, coalitional work, is really where we need to be, don't you think?
For so many years, it's been organizers and lawyers, people who are detained, their family members, policy folks in D.C., all of them coming together. I mean, we've actually won a lot of our campaigns in the last many years. Some 20 detention centers are no longer in use because of local and state and federal level campaigns to stop their use. And a lot of that is because a lot of different people from different sectors came together and ordinary people in their communities who said, no, we don't want this. And so I think that's absolutely true. There is no single way. And I'm so grateful to all the people who are doing litigation to stop those executive orders right now. And I also know that ICE already has the tools it needs to target people. And so we have to do work at all the different levels and make sure we're doing everything we can to protect communities. We also saw recently that ICE finally started putting out announcements about how they're going to expand detention. They're saying they're going to build 4 new 10,000 bed facilities, which is just absolutely unheard of. Wow. But, you know, we're doing the work to research that, figure that out, and do everything we can to block those. And we blocked it before, and I think we can do it again. And so just holding on to that sort of spirit of resistance and knowing that this is going to be a tough time, but also there's a lot of people who are ready to do the work and to make sure we can protect our communities as much as possible.
We've been speaking with Silky Shah, Executive Director at Detention Watch Network. Follow their work online at detentionwatchnetwork.org. Silky Shah, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. The website's also the place to show support for Counterspin if you are able and so inclined. The show is engineered by Riley Baer. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin. Thank you. Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, while the New York Times rolls out claptrap about how both the left and the right have ideas about causes behind the devastating Los Angeles wildfires, the right, you see, blame DEI hires, while the left blame climate change. Many people have moved beyond that sort of stultifying nonsense to work that directly confronts the fossil fuel companies and their political enablers for the obvious role that fossil fuels play in climate disruption and that climate disruption plays in extreme weather events. Many are also now calling out insurance companies that take folks' money but then hinder their ability to come out from under when these predictable and predicted crises occur. Would you be surprised to hear that these powerful industries, fossil fuels and insurers, are intertwined? We talked about it last year with writer and historian Derek Seidman. We'll hear that conversation on today's show. Also on the show, did you see the coverage of how people with disabilities are dealing with California fire's impact? Probably not, given that the place of people with disabilities in elite news media coverage.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
It's a slippery slope when we think it's okay to suspend the Constitution of the United States in order to make a political point or statement.
As the Trump administration ramps up immigration raids across the country, cities are pushing back. We'll go to Newark, New Jersey, and Chicago, then to the Congo, where Rwandan-backed M23 fighters have entered the eastern Congolese city of Goma.
Le peuple congolais ne cédera ni à la résignation ni à l'injustice.
The Congolese people will not cede to this injustice. We will continue to defend our rights, protect our territory, and demand respect and sovereignty. History will judge the world's response to this call.
We'll also look at the civil war in Sudan, where a drone struck a hospital Friday, killing at least 70 people. And finally, Holocaust survivors mark 80 years since the liberation of Auschwitz. We'll speak to the Israeli-American Holocaust scholar Roz Siegel about Gaza and his latest article, Genocide Denial in Holocaust Studies. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department Monday fired over a dozen officials who work with Special Counsel Jack Smith on now-dismissed criminal investigations into Donald Trump. Acting Attorney General James McHenry said they could not be trusted to faithfully implement Trump's agenda. Meanwhile, Ed Martin, the interim Trump-appointed U.S. attorney in Washington, D.C., launched an investigation into prosecutors who brought obstruction charges against some 250 January 6th Capitol rioters. Those charges ended up being tossed after a Supreme Court ruling last year. In related news, the Justice Department has removed a database from its website, which detailed crimes and convictions from the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Workers at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have been ordered to stop working with the World Health Organization immediately. The hasty directive came as a surprise to CDC workers, many of whom are working on crucial public health projects aimed at preventing major outbreaks of Marburg virus, Mpox, and bird flu. Trump's day one executive order withdrawing the U.S. from the WHO requires a one-year notice, the approval of Congress, and for the U.S. to still fulfill its financial commitment for the fiscal year. On Monday, President Trump signed four executive orders aimed at reshaping the military, including reinstating 8,000 military members who were relieved of duty for refusing to get a COVID-19 vaccine. He also issued an order banning DEI, that's diversity, equity, and inclusion, from the military, an order to build a missile defense system modeled on Israel's Iron Dome, and an order to review the Pentagon's policy on transgender military members in what's believed to be the first step towards a ban on transgender military members. The acting head of the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, issued an agency memo ordering a pause to federal aid, including grants and loans, but exempting Medicaid and Social Security benefits. According to the leaked memo, the pause includes, quote, financial assistance for foreign aid, non-governmental organizations, DEI, woke gender ideology, and the Green New Deal, unquote. Senator Patty Murray and Congressmember Rosa DeLauro, top Democratic members of their respective appropriations committees, said in a letter to the OMB, quote, the scope of what you're ordering is breathtaking, unprecedented, and will have devastating consequences across the country, unquote. The Navajo Nation reports at least 15 Native Americans in Arizona and